You ever watch this guy on television?
You all were not telling the truth, and you should not be trusted.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, thank you for what you did for your country tonight.
Be offended with the Democratic whip, not House Republicans.
Like a machine, Matt Gaetz.
Welcome to Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk about the news. And the news in the Sunshine State is that the proxy fight might be on in Congressional District 13. Currently held by former Republican Florida Governor Charlie Crist, turned failed independent candidate for the United States Senate, turned failed Democrat candidate for governor, then successful Democrat for Congress, elected in the Pinellas County area. He won that seat from David Jolly, who himself has sort of been square dancing with the parties, going from Republican to, I don't know if he was a Democrat. At one point, he was talking about running for some state office alongside Patrick Murphy. So working with the Democrats, I guess now David Jolly's an independent. Send us a Republican fighter from District 13. Please send backups, at least somebody that'll stick with a party, for goodness sakes. So Steve Contorto with the Tampa Bay Times has the story, and it lays out a primary dynamic with Amanda Mackey, a former D.C. lobbyist, now Republican candidate in District 13, getting the support of Kevin McCarthy, Steve Scalise, Liz Cheney, kind of the Republican established leadership in the House of Representatives, and then Ana Paulina Luna, a more of an outsider candidate, a conservative activist, served our military in uniform, also a military spouse, and she got the endorsement of Charlie Kirk. She got my endorsement. That's laid out in Steve Contorto's piece. And what I think is interesting about it, you know, the podcast is not an appropriate platform to litigate someone's campaign, but I do think that the policies that the Republican conference embraces are appropriate for discussion. And throughout some of these primaries, you've typically seen more gravitation to the Freedom Caucus, more of a desire to embrace the Trump brand than the neoconservative brand. And in the state of Florida, Steve Contorto writes that this primary, where you've got sort of the Washington establishment candidate against the outsider candidate, says a lot about what the conference will look like and what the motivations will be for the party to try to attract and appeal to different kinds of candidates, different types of constituencies. And that ultimately gets reflected in policy. You know, when we have shutdowns looming and the Republicans are only able to argue for, you know, a few things to try to get the government rolling and to try to have some accord with the Democrats, what are we going to fight for? You know, are we going to fight for just the corporate boardrooms, or are we going to fight for Main Street? Are we going to fight for that populist energy in our party that wants to see immigration reform, that wants to see fair trade deals, that wants to see our president supported? And not everyone in Republican leadership has traditionally supported the president. So we need a Republican caucus that is very pro-Trump more than they are pro-Washington if you want to see the pro-Trump agenda executed. Great piece by Steve Contorto. Check it out. See what you think it means for the future of the policies emanating from the Republican conference. Mike Pence on Hannity last night. Take a listen.
And Joe Biden's decision to add Kamala Harris to the ticket confirms everything President Trump and I have been saying, and that is that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party have been overtaken by the radical left. Kamala Harris, like Joe Biden, supports higher taxes, socialized medicine, open borders, abortion on demand. And where Joe Biden said he'd be willing to cut funding to police, she said recently that she thought that we should reimagine the police in this country.
Reimagine police? Here's what I want to imagine. I want to imagine that if my family is in trouble, if my safety is in question, that I'm going to be able to call the police and a non-imaginary cop is going to arrive to provide assistance and service and care. You know, this notion that you have to reimagine policing, I think, undermines the value of policing as it exists. And I think that policing oftentimes draws some of our best fellow Americans to service of their communities, of their state, of their country. And this critique that just chips away at law enforcement, I think is counterproductive to a safe and strong and stable union. And I think it's quite telling that, you know, Kamala Harris wants to reimagine your police, whereas Donald Trump and Mike Pence seem to want the police to be supported and equipped and trained and capable to help out their fellow Americans. Former Vice President Joe Biden and Kamala Harris making their first appearance as a ticket. Kamala Harris, here she is.
65,000 lives that have been cut short. Many with loved ones who never got the chance to say goodbye. It didn't have to be this way. 6 years ago, in fact, we had a different health crisis. It was called Ebola. And we all remember that pandemic. But you know what happened then? Barack Obama and Joe Biden did their job. Only two people in the United States died. Two. That is what's called leadership.
Ebola. There is no comparability with Ebola and coronavirus. They don't spread the same way. They're not as contagious. One major difference is that African countries dealing with Ebola didn't lie to our country for months. They didn't withhold the genome sequence for, you know, weeks. So I think that to in any way characterize the coronavirus challenge as akin to the Ebola challenge is just pretty tone deaf. And for that to be sort of the opening monologue of Kamala Harris to the nation as Joe Biden's running mate, I don't know. Did they plan this, or was this sort of her kind of off the cuff remarks? I can't imagine they would want to draw attention to that comparison because I think most Americans see that what we're dealing with now is something vastly different. Undemoralize yourself. Don't we all need a little undemoralization at this point? Jeff Giese writes for The American Mind in partnership with the Claremont Institute, a brilliant piece. Four steps. First, create from everything. View the interactions and opportunities throughout your daily life as a chance to create, build, establish. And really, Jeff writes here about how people can draw on faith for this, that really your faith can be a guide, a path to the notion of building and creating for people of faith. Second rule, preparedness. You know, this helps us with anti-fragility. It helps us capture the most joy out of moments if we're ready for them and able to fully capitalize on them. So don't go about your day just kind of stumbling from one unprepared moment to another. Take the time, be prepared. It will really help you just squeeze the most joy out of each day. Third, execute on a bold vision. You know, I think that in the coronavirus pandemic, whether it's the work of the Congress seeing things in a very small and petty and reductive way, whether it's these protests and riots that seem to unfairly generalize the police in a negative light, I think we need to raise our gaze as a country. And that bold vision is certainly a phenomenal feature of that. Fourth, happy on the homestead. I cannot stress how important this is. When you're happy at home, when you're able to have some detachment from the challenges that you face in a professional environment, when you come to a place of joy, I just think that it contributes positively to every other aspect of life. So great piece by Jeff Giese. Jeff also a phenomenal follow on Twitter. Not always, you know, a total, advocate for the president. He'll be critical of the president at times, but certainly I think represents a lot of the America First values that we're fighting for in Washington. Check out the piece. The smearing of Marjorie Greene, Republican candidate for Congress in Georgia's 14th District, is on in Washington, D.C. It's really been on for quite some time, but now with Marjorie Greene winning the Republican primary, you see the mainstream media starting to attack her with just a far greater intensity. And there's also a different feature of this news story that I'm going to reveal to you in a moment. It comes to us from Politico. Melanie Zanona, the title of the article, McCarthy Faces QAnon Squeeze. And the substance of the article is really an attack on things that Green has said. They tried to associate her with QAnon and other comments. Look, I've endorsed Marjorie Green. I don't think that when you endorse a candidate for office because you support their policy positions, you look at their background. This is a very successful businesswoman from the Georgia area. When you see that they want to, you know, join with the conservative pro-Trump fighters to try to ensure that our leadership is responsive to the base of our party, to the people who animate our movement. You know, I saw Marjorie Greene as an ally in a lot of those ways. Now, does that mean that I know everything she's ever said online, every video, every tweet? Does that mean I endorse everything she's ever said? Of course not. Just as she probably, if she, you know, she looked through every tweet, every comment, every email, every video I've made, there might be things she would disagree with. So let's all be adult enough to realize, like, that in any offer and acceptance of endorsement, there is not like a total alignment or agreement. You're just saying you see this person as someone who can be an ally in getting the things done that are really important to you. And that is very significant. That's why I've got involved in helping a few candidates who I think can provide backup for the president and the president's agenda. And that oftentimes means motivating and even pushing up against the leadership in your own party. The president knows that. We all know that. So that brings us to the game that's going on that is being played behind the scenes, I think, in this story and in the whole Marjorie Greene saga. Look at who this comes from. Melanie Zanona at Politico. And look who it criticizes. McCarthy. Now, I know Melanie. I like Melanie. But it's very clear that she has a close, close relationship with the Liz Cheney press shop. And there is, of course, tension and competitiveness between Kevin McCarthy and Liz Cheney. They both probably want to be Speaker of the House one day. They both realize that the types of candidates who are elected can influence the shape and feel and tenor of the Republican conference and ultimately inform on who its leader will be. And Melanie Zanona has gone all in with the Liz Cheney ambition to this objective, right? I mean, she writes glowing profiles on Liz. She casts Liz in the best possible light when there's conflict within the conference. And here she uses Marjorie Taylor Greene's winning of the Republican nomination as a basis to attack McCarthy. And I don't think that, you know, that criticism is fair. I mean, look, I don't agree with Kevin McCarthy on a lot of things. We do agree on many others, right? We've worked together closely. We've found ourselves on the other side. But it is certainly not Kevin McCarthy's fault that Marjorie Greene won. It's not anyone's fault. It's democracy's fault, okay? I mean, like, Marjorie Greene is the winner of the Republican nomination. She is a dynamic and interesting candidate in a lot of ways to her voters. And I find her to be a businesswoman with sound experience who can add a lot to our conference. So I welcome Marjorie Greene. I'm enthusiastic about my endorsement of her, but it's just interesting that kind of the school newspapers in Washington, like Politico, try to use any controversy to smear someone even before they arrive. And they also try to use any sort of moment to juxtapose one person's ambition against another. And here, Melanie Zanona and the Liz Cheney team clearly saw it acceptable to use Marjorie Greene's victory in her primary as a basis not only to smear Greene, but to smear McCarthy as well. Undeserved. Let's do better. Welcome to the team, Marjorie Taylor Greene. School reopening, such a critical element of society. I've talked about it a great deal on the podcast. Anna Sabalos with the News Service of Florida has some interesting anecdotal survey results from a few counties in Florida, Pinellas County, which is in the Tampa area, Jackson County, more around the Florida panhandle. And in those places, you're seeing about 1% of teachers choosing to retire, take leave, and not come back to the educational setting. And I think there's a policy opportunity here. I think if you have older teachers in this era of pandemic who just simply do not have the skill set to do digital learning. Some do, but some don't. And if they're older, if they're medically frail, why not allow teachers who are close to retirement to buy into their retirement? So if you've got, you know, 28 years in and you're waiting to get to those 30 years, maybe there's a way to get that 30 year by buying into it somehow as an educator. And we could create different paths for people to do that, whether it's cashing in leave time, whether it's a lump sum payment, whether it's an election of certain benefits and a change to benefits, but be able to access them sooner. I think that there's a win-win opportunity to ensure that we've got the safest, most effective education workforce, whereas some of those teachers toward the end of their profession, nearing retirement, wouldn't just get totally screwed by a system that asks them to either go back and be in a setting that wouldn't be necessarily endorsed by their own healthcare professionals, their own doctors, or not to be able to fully benefit from their years of service to the various states and school districts around the country. So let's get creative with the policy options. But interesting in Anna Sabalos' report that we don't see the like mass exodus of the teaching profession, about 1%. I think we can accommodate that 1% with good public policy. Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys, says that they're going to be playing in front of fans. Listen to his live Q&A with reporters.
But we've got some adjustments to make. We're going to make them with enthusiasm, and we're going to make them with can-do. The Dallas Cowboys plan on playing all of our football games, and we plan on playing it in front of our fans. So
I think it's a good thing for our titans of industry, sports, culture to be ambitious about the opportunities that we'll have for safe public gatherings again, whether that's mask wearing, temperature checks, on-site testing. You know, I think that we need the brightest minds. We need the most ambitious people working to try to return our country to the things that we love and enjoy. And certainly going out with our fellow Americans and enjoying athletics and observing them is a great pastime that I'd love to see us get back to. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. Give us a 5-star rating, leave us a review, let us know what you'd like to hear on the show, and make sure to tune in tomorrow for more Hot Takes.